Hello and welcome to edition 354 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be talking books, publishing, and how the written word is still creating new and ever more inventive chapters with Jürgen Buchs, director of the Frankfurt Book Fair.
We'll also be hearing about a plan to build a new skyscraper for London out of wood. Architect Kevin Flanagan of PLP Architecture will be explaining timber's evergreen appeal.
And we'll be talking to Guy Andrews, whose new book, Magnum Cycling, tells the story of both pedal power and photography across a collection of winning imagery.
All that's coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Reece Sheridan will be taking the yellow jersey of journalistic mismanagement in the news look ahead. And we'll have some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we go, Tom. How was your week? Was it lovely? Did the sun shine upon you?
The sun did shine, in part. It very much felt in London as if spring had properly sprung. Maybe even the summertime could be on the way, Rob.
Was it Tip Monday?
Come again?
You know, this day, we probably shouldn't talk about it on the
Sunday
radio show.
No, I think an international radio station is exactly the place to...
to talk about this. I mean, far be it for me to say this is the kind of verbiage you pick up on a building site. But I think this is the day of the year when people start to come out.
I think that's right.
After,
people let it all hang out.
And,
that's right. The sun is shining, and it warms the cockles.
It does. No, we should say this because this is obviously a story about bird. You know, whatever birds you see on your bird table. I don't know whether you have a feeder up with nuts in, perhaps in your garden. Tom.
No, I always get my nuts out in my garden, Rob, and keep an eye out for the local tits as well, and see what when the two come together, it's a great moment.
It's a great moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's what we've been. That's definitely what we're talking about there. In other news.
Let's talk about next week's news right now. Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, blow the way Texas hop. But how am I doing now? Everything is all right.
Henry, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks very much, Rob. I appreciate you having me.
What's
funny about
that? I don't know what's funny. It's just we're in a bit of a silly mood, I think,
just
today. Flight. It's fine. It's fine. I think spring's got to us. We're feeling like Tiggerish. T-I-double-G-R.
And you have what I would describe as a sunshine aspect about you right now, Henry.
Go on.
Well, no, that was that.
All right, okay. Just leave it at that.
Glinting.
I was going to wear a T-shirt today, actually, but because I'm wearing my fashionable jogging bottoms on the bottom half, it looked like I was wearing my pyjamas, so I thought I'd have to put on a button-up. But
yeah.
I was going to look even springier than you claim I do.
Maybe
now.
A collar and tie for next week's edition.
Moving on. The 17th of... This is the news. We're going to go into the news.
Yeah, okay.
Are you happy with that?
Yeah.
On the 17th of April 2016, today, Brazil's lower house is going to vote on the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. She has been accused of fiddling the books. It's a big day, obviously, and there's been an extremely long and turbulent run-up to it.
It's been a political saga.
I would go as far as to say it's been a political saga. Rob, would you agree?
I'd say it's been something like a sandstorm, a something else storm. Let's not say it on the radio.
It's just a bit early. A bit early for what kind of storm.
I've already talked about the birds in Tom Edwards' garden.
It's already been a bit purple, hasn't it?
It's been a bit blue.
I'm not going to pretend otherwise. I don't want to delve into the complexity of this and begin to make very precise predictions.
No.
I'll make a prediction. I'll throw one out there. I think Dilma will be fine.
Really? Why?
Because she only needs to get a quarter, I think it is, of the support in that vote. In the preliminary vote, it was much closer than that. It was like 55 to 45%. So it's very close. I think she should be fine.
What you're saying, Tom, there needs to be a supermajority in order to actually impeach her, which is probably not going to be reached.
I mean, I wouldn't say super, but, you know, decent.
I've not got much more to say about that, so I'm going to move on to a topic which I do have more to say about. On the 19th of April 2016, a presidential primary is taking place in New York. It's the US presidential primary, and it's a very important vote. One of my favourite tidbits of news that came out last week about this is that Trump's children, Eric and Ivanka Trump, can't vote for him because they didn't register in time. Everyone laughed at them, but it subsequently emerged.
Gets them out of an embarrassing thing to have to do, though, doesn't it?
What?
Think about that.
After having to vote for their own dad.
I thought you were going to say, explain to your dad why you're not voting for him, which may well be the case.
Exactly.
What's interesting is that on the back of this revelation and all the kind of mocking that's come along with it, it's actually emerged that it's an extraordinarily kind of onerous process to actually register with the correct party to vote in the closed primaries in New York. And lots of ordinary non-Trump people have fallen foul of this process as well. So I think that's really interesting. It kind of was a trivia story which kicked off a serious debate. Lots of people have been excluded. There's a very narrow window in which to register with a particular party to be included in the nomination process. So there's been a lot of, particularly on the Democratic side, I think, discontent expressed about how you have to be quite a motivated and involved political weirdo to even be aware of the rules to be able to participate in this. And I'm sure that this is going to become a bigger debate as the campaign goes on.
Okay, so it'll be one of those things like Dunny in the World, where two people vote and one of them is a Dachshund called Colin.
That I think that's what's going to happen.
Okay.
We can look forward to that.
Yeah, we can. Standing at the back looking silly, waving something silly party will triumph.
Exactly.
Whichever one of those two parties, you can make up your own mind as to which one that is.
I think we can look forward to that. I've got some stats here, but I can't read them now. Clinton's leading, no surprise. It's Clinton country. And I think Trump remains ahead, bizarrely, even in New York as well, among the Republicans there.
Yeah.
So it's going to be fun. And then it's a busy week in New York, because the day before that, on the 18th, the Pulitzer Prizes are being announced in New York.
Whoa.
Now,
better hire a tuxedo for that. Am I not up for one? I'm getting a little word in my shell-like ear from our producer, Tom Hall, that actually I'm not on this year.
Again.
Not been nominated.
Again.
Once more.
Yeah.
Astonishing.
For my media brief where I reviewed a pair of headphones.
Categories include, I didn't know this, there's one for musical composition. I thought it was like a strictly a word award.
Me too, yeah.
But they do notes as well.
What a sellout.
Yeah,
I
know.
It's just about for novels. And...
Well, it's been diluted, hasn't it, by tabloid culture.
Yeah.
Aaron Copland won one of them.
Drummer in the Police.
Yeah, that's right.
Love his work.
Sting was very angry, missed out.
Yeah. So Jet used to fight, didn't they, over things like that?
I think so.
Number ones, Pulitzers, you name it.
What's the other one?
There's always a black eye.
There's Sumners.
There's Sting. There's an Andy Summer.
That's it.
Who's the guitarist?
I don't know how we got onto the Police, but yeah, they don't actually announce any. I wanted to talk about, you know, who's up for it, who's not up for it. Like, you know, the Oscars go into a little bit of a kind of drama, but they don't actually announce even the short or long list before they actually announce the winners, which I think doesn't make for a very good spectator event.
Yeah, but it adds to the surprise, doesn't it? That's a dynamic event right there. Who's won? Here they are.
That's not dynamic.
Who knows?
That's just surprising. A surprise doesn't necessarily have to be dynamic. They just announce it. Do you know what I mean? And then there's...
I like it.
Do you?
Yeah.
It makes it feel decisive to me.
Really?
Yeah.
And what? Does it lend more trust to the selection process in your eyes?
They didn't even need to float the options.
Yeah.
I don't think they need to even really tell anyone. They just go...
Don't announce it at all.
No, just not bother.
Just call it off. Just get one bloke to make his mind up in a room.
And
then just let the world know it's happening.
Yeah, just tell the winner and then he can do as he or she sees.
Yeah, just someone in the room going, well, I really like Michael Frayn, for example. And that's it.
That's the whole event.
Yeah, that's just the whole event.
Not even the utterance, that thought.
Is there a lot of money involved in the Pulitzer Prize?
I haven't checked, Rob. Do you want me to look at it now?
No, it's fine.
Mainly, I think the reward is predominantly symbolic. It's obviously a very Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
On the 21st of April 2016, very important day on this side of the pond, Our Majesty the Queen is celebrating her 90th birthday.
When is she doing that?
That's on the 21st.
Is this her actual birthday or her official birthday?
Because she has two, doesn't she? Which I've never...
Does she, like Jesus, Christmas, and then whenever he was actually born.
Yeah.
Never really got on board with that, to be honest.
What, the double birthday? What, Jesus or the Queen?
No, the Queen, you know, taking two birthdays.
Yeah, one's not the coronation, is it? And one's her actual birthday, or is it?
It's her actual birthday. Yeah.
I think it was the anniversary of her coronation, but she was born as the Queen of England, and one is her actual birthday. I think her actual birthday is the one, right?
I'm not going to come down the other side of that debate. I don't know, but you know,
how will you be marking the day? A staunch royalist as you are, will you be wearing?
To be honest with you,
traditional garments.
I was brought up in a kind of almost militantly Republican family, but you know what? As I've got older, as I've mellowed, I think 1953, she'd been in the job. Fair play, Liz. You know what I mean? She's not done too many things wrong. It's not an easy job. I think the British monarchy has been very good at managing.
It is quite an easy job, isn't it?
It's a relatively easy job, probably in the grand scheme of things. But nonetheless, there's a lot of importance, actually. There's a lot of responsibility, at least formally.
Let's ask someone a question here. Would you rather run Monocle 24 Radio or be the Queen?
When you say be the queen, how far down that road? Can I just still be myself?
We're talking about a face-off situation. No, an actual transfer. Like
I don't want to actually be a 94-year-old woman or however old she is.
She's 90. She's not even 90 yet. 90.
Now I feel
she's 89 till next
week. I'm going to wind up in the tower because
you
of
are.
This.
You're going to feel a full force.
Listen, I have a great deal of respect for her.
Imagine all that beef you're going to be made to eat.
I mean, I'm not sure how to kind of bring raise the brow again up to a fit for public consumption.
What else is happening next week, Henry?
Pulitzer Prize, Queen's birthday.
Yep.
Trump, what else? America.
The primary. Yeah. And at the beginning, Dilma.
I always get really.
Oh, Dilma. And Dilma. The big impeachment vote.
Dilma.
Jesus.
Just funny on the American primaries, the presidential primaries.
Yeah.
Does that mean anything, or is that another one of these things that is going towards who's going to actually
be
running?
Delegate count ratchets up another level.
But this isn't. Okay.
Right. Yeah, but the Democratic one isn't as fun because they reward proportionately. There'll come a point in the Republican thing, I think, where like it could be one or the other. But
they need some beef eaters.
I'm sure they'll be receptive to that. To that criticism if you write into them, Rob. You should write into that. I don't know who you'd write into.
Or
both
Chelsea
parties.
Pensioner or something. They need some men in red coats, I think.
Get Liz involved as a campaign advisor.
Come on.
Thank you very much indeed, Henry. An excellent preview of next week's news today, as always. Coming up next, we're talking the Frankfurt Book Fair. Stay tuned. The Frankfurt Book Fair is the world's largest gathering for publishers, authors and, of course, readers that takes place every October in Frankfurt. The director of the fair, Jürgen Buss, was in London this week for the city's own celebration of the written word. A little earlier, Rob sat down with Jürgen to discuss the world of publishing and where its future might be headed.
Jürgen, thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. And this is an interesting thing. You're bringing a bit of the spirit of the Frankfurt Book Fair to London this week during the London Book Fair. But I wanted to ask you about the success of Frankfurt and why so many people actually get together in a messe, in a huge meeting hall to talk about books, to do deals. I thought that the world worked online now. What is this with meeting up?
Oh, Frankfurt has quite a tradition. It's been around for 500 years and... In the past 30 years since I'm in publishing, I've seen the Xerox machine, the fax machine coming up, internet coming up. And actually, it's all about the storytelling. Yeah, it's not about the media. And Frankfurt has always been a place where everybody in the media industry, in the publishing industry would meet because it's a personal business. You have to trust the people. If you sell rights to another country, to have to see these people at least once a year, actually to build up this trust.
So this is an idea of giving people a handshake, of looking people in the eye, of doing deals very much. It's about meeting people, I guess, right? This business.
It's networking. It's really networking and has been like this, as I said, for hundreds of years because storytelling, it's a very intimate business. And you, as a writer, you stay at home. You don't talk a lot to the people, but then you want the people to read your story. And then you have to talk to the people. You have to go out. You have to see editors. You have to see translators. And these people actually... Yeah, try to sell your story to the audience all around the world.
And in your time at Frankfurt and doing this, have you seen the book trade ebb and flow? I mean, 5 years ago, everyone was talking about e-readers and digital publishing and stuff. That seems to have kind of come and not gone, but it seems to have settled down into maybe a rhythm that you can understand a little more, that we can see a little bit more closely. Does it feel like a tide has come in and gone out a little bit?
Yeah, actually, I've seen cycles, and it might be even seven-year cycles.
Right.
Everybody's saying that the book might die, and I've seen this now so many times. I'm 50-something, so I've seen it quite often coming, these seven-year cycles, but the book never went away. And the book doesn't mind whether it's a printed book or whether it's an electronic book. It can be an audio book. It can be on YouTube, so it really doesn't mind.
And how do you judge a successful incarnation of the Frankfurt Book Fair? Is it the loudness of the room? Is it the quietness of the room? Is it the people that you know don't know each other actually meeting for the first time? What represents success for you?
I think that people in publishing and bookselling, they tend to be a big family. And it doesn't matter. When I'm traveling to Jakarta, to Indonesia, it's the same mindset. People are really in it, not really for the money. It's an industry on the one hand, but on the other hand, you have to be very dedicated, you have to be motivated, you have to be passionate. And this brings the people together. And they need to have one place in the world where they would meet everybody who shares this passion.
And what about the kind of quality of books? I mean, the physical quality of books. as you know, we make our own books here at Monocle. We have an eye on the prize in terms of the quality of publishing. We work with Gestalten, for example. Is that something that people have focused on more in terms of these seven-year cycles that you're talking about? Do you see more beautifully bound books than maybe you did before, where the buy 'em cheap and sell 'em high philosophy might have changed a little bit?
Yeah, this changed completely. You're completely right. Yeah. In the past 3-4 years, we've seen a lot more beautiful bound printed books than ever before. And I think this might be a reaction on the digital book. Yeah. And even people now care how a digital book looks like. Even there, the quality is a lot better. So we've seen a lot of change and people put a lot more effort into it. Somehow a book also became a luxury good and a statement, really.
And I guess there is that thing, right? It becomes a collectible, covetable thing that people are proud to have. Maybe people have a version of something on their phone, but actually people want to... It's very giftable, I suppose, as well.
It's very giftable, right? Yeah.
I suppose there is that. And just finally, I mean, as you say, you've worked in this business for a while. The Frankfurt Book Fair It's a friendly family, but it's a fierce thing. I mean, you need a bit of a survival guide, right, for that week.
True.
It's pretty busy. What's the secret? You told me that you had 10 espressos for breakfast, but other than that, how do you survive a week like that?
As I said, it's all about passion, and I love our industry. I love publishing. I love bookselling. And I think everybody who comes to Frankfurt doesn't sleep for a week at least. Yeah? People tend to come in very early. They meet their friends before they actually go to the fair. And they need like 2 weeks to recover afterwards, at least. And you see a lot of people now coming from Southeast Asia and they have to travel for 24 hours to get there. So they really don't sleep for a week. And everybody wants to party as well. So this fair doesn't stop in the night.
Oh, yeah, the parties are pretty good. So
the parties are pretty good. It's a lot of fun, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So these are your shy retiring writers. They're not-so-shy retiring agents and the poor benighted book trade all getting together and painting the town red, I guess.
Yes, it's really like that. And people coming into town really to share their experience. Yeah, and if you're a publisher in Myanmar, yeah, you've been never exposed to an international community. And now 2 years ago, the country opened up and now you already have a functioning publishing industry. And these people want to make contacts and they want to share what has happened in the past 20 years in Myanmar. Yeah, so they come and speak out loud. They want to sell their books. They want to share their experience. And this doesn't stop for a week.
And talking about that, actually, in terms of national focus, there is always a national focus at Frankfurt. How natural does that feel to have that natural focus in a world that feels very interconnected?
Yeah, on the one hand, the world really became global. On the other hand, all publishing is local.
Yeah, yeah,
it comes from an experience of a writer, how he grew up in his society, yeah, with his people. But again, he wants to share this. So he has to, on the one hand, it's very local. On the other hand, it's very global. And right now we have this meeting place in Frankfurt. People also come to London to meet here. They would go to Bologna for the children book business. Mm. So these people travel really a lot. And it has been like this since I'm in publishing or for many, many years before that.
And does it feel like the world's getting bigger or the world's getting smaller, actually? You know what I mean? I mean,
the
world gets more connected, but at the same time, there are more stories, more differences you notice between things.
Yeah, on the one hand, it's both things. Actually, what we're seeing in the past 2 years, that the world has become a lot more political, and that nationalism is rising. So you also have the voices who promote nationalism on the one hand. On the other hand, it's so easy to exchange ideas, and you can cross the borders more easily than you could ever have done with the internet and with distribution systems. So it's very cheap now to ship books, which wasn't like this 10, 15 years ago. So we have both experiences, the global and the local experience.
And that's, what about the challenges to something like Frankfurt? We talked about the fact that people maybe thought that Skype might change the world because you could sit on a video conference with someone. All sorts of things are supposed to have killed the book and actually supposed to have killed the conference and the kind of gathering together of tribes of different people all kind of under the same umbrella. So if technology isn't a challenge to the business of books and to the business of putting on a fair, well, I wonder what your challenge is, what you see your challenges as being.
I think the biggest challenge right now is that we have to bring in a lot of more people. Yeah, in the past, it was the printed book, then it was the electronic book. Now we're seeing YouTube being very, very important for us. We see small communities with huge followers, and it's all about storytelling again. So what's dealt with in Frankfurt, it's intellectual property. And this can be moving images. This can be everything. Yeah. So we see a lot of more people bringing in merchandise stuff. We see people from the film industry, from the games industry, And all of these industries actually have been very secluded. And now we have to merge this. And this is happening in Frankfurt. So it's people, a film does have a completely different life cycle as a book. A film takes years to make, to get find the money. Mm. That takes 5 to 7 years actually to get a film out. And with a book, you have like 6 month cycles. If it's a translation, maybe 18 months. But so these people are not used to talk to each other. And this is our challenge, to bring the people together and that they are going to trust each other and they can understand each other.
And actually, do you do anything to bring those people together physically, or is it just allowing them to be in a convivial environment? Do you actually?
No, we have to set up a lot of matchmakings. We have to meet the people. We are setting up conference programs. We are training people actually how to talk to each other. And Frankfurt is not only these 5 days in October. It's all year round. So mm-hmm. our staff travels a lot. We go to a lot of other places. We attend conferences. We are very close with the Cannes Film Festival, with the Berlinale Film Festival. We would go to meet people, yeah, where the gatherings are from these other industries. And make friends and bring these friends to Frankfurt.
A lot of laurel wreaths have been draped around a lot of heads all over the world. Jürgen Boost, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Robert Bound talking to Jürgen Boost, director of the Frankfurt Book Fair. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Hello. Have we been introduced properly? We should get to know each other a bit better. We're Monocle 24, the radio station brought to you from the makers of Monocle magazine, the global print title that was launched in 2007 to deliver a briefing on everything from affairs to design. Headquartered in London, Monocle has built up a network of bureau in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, Istanbul, New York, and Toronto. And we also run our own stores and cafes where you can get a good coffee, a nice cake, and a copy of the magazine too. Then there's Monocle.com, where you can listen to this radio station and all our archived shows, watch the films made by our film team, and visit our e-commerce store. Intrigued? I just knew we'd get along.
Time for some new music now. From France, this is M83 with Go. That was M83 with Go, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
The evolving London skyline has in recent years gone under something of a fairly drastic retrofit. Tall towers in irregular shapes are springing up with whimsical names such as the Gherkin, the Shard and the Walkie Talkie. They will transform the view of the city for decades to come, and they have both fans and critics alike.
But what if we could make tall buildings a softer, less intrusive and more natural part of the city? That's the hope of a newly proposed plan from PLP Architecture and researchers from the University of Cambridge. They want to build London's first wooden skyscraper, a 300-metre tall, 80-storey structure that would sit in the city's Barbican estate, named Oakwood Tower. Kevin Flanagan, partner at PLP Architecture, joins us now to discuss how this idea came about. Kevin, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
There is only really one place to start, and that is in the choice of materials. As soon as someone says to me, oh, a 300-metre tower, I instantly think, well, you couldn't possibly make something like that out of wood. But I would, as with so many things in life, be quite wrong. Tell us a bit about the genesis of this.
Okay. We were invited by Cambridge University to really develop the notion further. They have been doing studies with wood as a natural material for use. And wood is, unlike so many building materials, it is something that can be used and reused. It's a crop that can be drawn from woodlands, and it has no environmental impact whatsoever. In fact, wood is about 50% carbon and therefore can lock in carbon, whereas concrete and steel produce carbon as a result of its manufacture. So wood can be made into panels, very light, lightweight panels that can be brought onto site quite quickly. And every child has played with sort of wood-type blocks. The notion really is that we can use that kind of methodology of single elements that can be stacked and repeated, brought to site quite quickly, weighing much, much less than other materials, concretes and steel, and really build buildings much more quickly, cheaply. And we also find psychologically people like wood better. There's a sense of relaxation. There's an association with nature that's very powerful. It's begun to be studied, particularly in the realm of education. But wood, we're not really talking about natural wood. This is engineered timbers, and that's an important distinction. Wood, though, has a property that it's cellular, very much like a bee's hive, wax.
I thought you'd brought a snack.
Before we launch into some more questions, shall we actually talk through some of the props that Kevin's brought into the studio?
Okay.
Because I think this is good. We heard the Jenga blocks that came out that you ran your fingers
through. Lincoln logs, we're calling them.
Okay. We have a honeycomb in an Altoids box. We have this thing, which is something else.
That's something else. Possibly.
Really, let's just call it something else.
R&D. It's another R&D.
And we've got the more traditional elements, like some drawings on paper and some cardboard show and tell panels. Let's call them
exactly.
So okay, so we've got all these things at our disposal. This is a radio show, so I think we're kind of lucky to have these sort of added elements. You told us about the kind of the cellular idea of wood and all the rest of it, Kevin. Tell us about all the idea of doing something which is friendly. We mentioned a few of the sort of newly iconic, or certainly famous, if not iconic buildings on the London skyline. Is friendliness an important thing to impart by the material that you choose as well?
Well, what's happened now, of course, you probably know that the majority of humanity now live in cities. London is a very good example of this. It's a city that is sitting by a river. Therefore, it has an engagement with nature. But what we also tend to find is that because of the character of cities, life can be stressful. And the character of wood apparently allows people to feel a little bit more at home, a little bit more, as you're saying, welcome as they enter their home or their school. And it improves people's outlook sufficiently that they're a little bit more alert. But more importantly, they're a little bit more sociable. So if you can create an urban setting that includes green space, that includes this notion of the use of timber, then the world doesn't quite seem as alien. And this is sort of the result of studies that have been done on general population, but children, particularly in school environments. So the material is interesting in itself. It has a lot of scope for development. There's even been discussion of using the cellulose in wood and refining it in such a way that it can become glass. So in effect, this tower could and has the potential of being fully made of wood, of timbers that can be created as a crop and drawn ad infinitum. And there certainly is enough timber in the world to allow us to build quite quickly many, many new homes for London.
What about the responsibility? I mean, Rob's already mentioned a couple of times this idea of the London skyline, and people, it is quite a divisive issue. As an architect in practice, do you ever feel, I don't know, the weight of that responsibility? Because people say, well, look, you know, this is something, you know, Christopher Wren gazed across here and saw this view. Does that necessarily have to enter your thinking when you're strategizing about this kind of thing?
Every city has its own culture. And in the case of London, after the war, because of the photographs really that were published after the bombing of the Dome of St. Paul's rising above the ashes, it is become now the center focus of much of the planning discussion having to do with the distant views and background views. The site location that we've chosen is completely out of any of these background views, luckily. But certainly the notion of the history of the city, and I love buildings, I love St. Paul's, its use of timber and its use of brick lining and stone. Buildings of those period were of their time. I'm sure you've seen Canaletto's paintings where the dome of St. Paul's is rising well above the city fabric, and now quite less so. And this really is not a bad thing. It really represents the advance of culture and the advancement of methods by which people can agree as you would in a proper democracy. It's a good thing that we have these discussions about what's appropriate, what's not, but also that they're discussions and not necessarily rules.
I was interested in what you were saying. You're sort of saying that, people have done studies into wood and the fact that they're good for children. You put wood panelling in a school classroom, you feel differently. Maybe a wood floor and things adds an idea of warmth. We feel like we're in the woods, or we have a connection to nature. Is that always research-led, or is it just a simple fact of life that people like wood because it is a natural thing? And that actually we add wood to properties, or we make timber frame properties and show off the fact that they're made of wood a bit, just because it's a natural instinct rather than something that we have to look into and study.
I think it's better to study it. I know that's
anecdotal. There's an architect, there's a man of training.
No. There's a man of science, but there's anecdotal evidence, of course, which is terrific. But what they do now is study the stress levels by testing blood of individuals in different settings. And this is even being done within offices to see which office space. They're finding that if you can reduce the level of stress, particular types of stress, your cognition is improved. If you're in a work environment, you work better with others. And the way that people now work is together in groups. So if you can create that sort of getting everybody in the zone, working together, discussing things openly, then you're going to be better prepared for the future and for future challenges. So I think this is all part of how cities should be really be made. They should be considering how people get on, you know, how people are made to be more sociable and integrate new ideas, because this is what the economy is going to be requiring.
Kevin, I guess that how cities and countries indeed around the world look at these ideas that you're talking about, thinking in a more integrated way, means that working in those different markets is presumably very, very different. Now, you've got years of experience working in all sorts of different markets. What are the best places to work? Is it where you're given license and free rein to be more creative, perhaps? Or is it counterintuitively, maybe where the constraints are actually much more sort of aggressive and you have to be more creative within a more confined sort of set of parameters? What's the best challenge as an architect actually going about your work?
That's an interesting question. A lot of that I'll respond because I was trained at the Architecture Association here. And part of that training involved reviewing and assessing the brief or whatever the guidelines that we were provided, and to really analyze those and try to create a poetry out of them. They're not simply facts and figures, they're aspirations. And very often we find when we read good briefs, you know, that have been well prepared, you get the essence of the problem, but in that lies the solution. And you do find that each culture has a different way of looking at things, but there's a common expression of the aspiration that you do get. And very typically, we win competitions when we can find that kernel of the challenge, and then it draws one's mind to how these things can be solved. Every culture has a deficit that's needing to be overcome, whether it's the outlook on particular aspects of society, on work, characters of work. And our job really is to look into the future and overcome these. We've just finished a project in Holland called The Edge. And interestingly, that client for Deloitte wanted us to design a building for them, which would be office space. But we also designed a common space in the middle of a grand atrium. And that space now has counterintuitively become the center of the office. People wish to work there. They don't work at their desks anymore. They work together in groups. They're not assigned chairs or seating. And it's turned the world of architecture really upside down in a way that's quite interesting to watch and observe how people use the space, but you have to be observant. You have to understand that different cultures and that things change, certainly.
We mentioned at the top that you had a bunch of big sort of designs. There's some photo images of what this could look like. Maybe mm-hmm. you seize one that's close to hand. I mean, just tell us a little bit then about exactly how this sits. It's plainly very, very elegant. It has a sort of lissom, tree-like quality to it. How does how it looks, say, in this the view you've got to hand there, speak to the qualities of the building, I guess?
Well, this is one of several. We have several different versions of it. This particular version used a diagonal strutting arrangement, but really what's important is to understand is that it made of modules of about 50 stories high that would be brought onto site at every two stories and linked together by a series of very strong diagonal struts. And at the top, the last diagonal strut actually forms the character of the very top of the building. So what we're trying to do is suggest that the building is being held up by something from the ground, that it rests very strongly and deeply and rooted in the ground, in the garden that's encircling the Barbican, which you can't quite see in this photograph, but nonetheless, it's rising from the garden, from the earth, from the landscape, rising. And then at each terraced level, there are four steps. There is a garden, a winter garden, which is really a public space at the top. I think you've probably been to the Fenchurch Street. Mm. And there's a grand garden at the top of the building. And that's a wonderful thing. It's a beautiful sight because the river bends at that point. And it really captures that sense that you're in a special place in the city. The geography is particular. And you feel almost as if you're at one with the river course that writhes through the city of London.
We've brought the Lincoln Logs along. Are we getting a bit of shorthand into your pitching process?
No, we spoke
with... I kind of would be very flattered if we were, wouldn't you, Tom?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We were discussing with Boris Johnson, this is how the project was introduced.
Yeah.
And what was terrific about him was that he was very enlivened by the notion that the building was wood, that it was really something that had been brought from nature, but it also was reminiscent for him of time when he was a small child. He comes from an arts family, I understand. You could sort of see him physically recollecting, handling these blocks. And he mentioned as his hands were very animated, describing how the blocks in his hands would allow him to build higher and higher and higher. And he couldn't quite keep himself from not playing with them. So this notion of building, of stacking repetitive forms, quite simple in themselves, but you were asking something about earlier about the fundamentals of architecture. That certainly is the notion of building things. It's not the essence of architecture, because the essence there is the notion behind it, what drives the desire to build and stack.
I've had a bit of a go there, Kevin. Yeah.
It's a modest first effort.
It's a modest effort. I think Kevin can advise you.
Yeah.
Is that a general thing, though? Do we get that from childhood, this idea of wanting to make structures? This is the discussion that we often have with the London skyline, with the skyline of cities all over the world, the desire to go higher and higher. What part of us is that satisfying, I wonder? Do you have to consider that when you're designing, when you're pitching, when you're going about your business?
For me, it's a personal thing. I think it has been somewhat ingrained in the city, in people's cultural memory, that the city center is the highest point in the city. When you think of animated films of the Emerald City, you think of these glistening glass and reflected catching the light as if they were mountains onto themselves. But you can understand them as condensations of all that is going around, that it's a center of knowledge, of a hive of people, that there's something special going on. And I think city skylines are really like that. They're signatures of the aspirations of the people. And of course, they also have this other side to them. They represent the vainglory of man for others to see. So they have an important physical dimension. They're practical in the sense that they bring people together, but there is also this sense that they're meant to be seen by others, and they represent your tribe by contrast to others. So if you go to Frankfurt, it has a particular skyline, quite different. Its geography is different also. London, quite different. Paris, quite different, magnificently so. you're getting these different expressions of different personalities and also different levels of importance for different aspects. Street life's very important in Paris, so things tend to be quite low. And in London, you have the patrimony of these great gardens that are encircled by quite low buildings. Certainly one of the great aspects of living in London.
Well, Kevin, it's been brilliant hearing all about this project and to hear about your work and your ideas about architecture more broadly. Great to speak with you on The Weekly. That's Kevin Flanagan. Kevin, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you very much.
Guy Andrews has been marrying cycling with great photography for much of his career, having founded Rouleur magazine a decade ago, the title dedicated to conveying the drama of pedal power across the printed page. Now he's collecting more great images in Magnum Cycling, a book dedicated to telling the story of not only some of the most iconic moments in the history of the sport, but also the photographers who immortalised them.
The book collects the work of photographers such as Henri Cartier-Bresson, Robert Capa and John Vink that recorded events ranging from the six-day races in Madison Square Garden in the 1930s to the more recent Grand Tours of France, Spain and Italy. And we're delighted to say Guy joins us on the line now from Mallorca to tell us more. Guy, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Welcome back to Monocle 24. I know you've spoken about Rouleau before on the stack, but great to talk with you about this amazing book. Just tell us, first of all, how important are the documenters, the photographers who follow cycling? In some ways, they are as much a part of the story as almost as some of cycling's greatest exponents.
Yes, I think that's very much the case, especially with my experience of working with the Magnum photographers. Certainly, you know, the likes of Cartier-Bresson and Robert Capa, as you mentioned at the top of the show. They're certainly integral to the race nowadays, especially, you know, photographers working very closely alongside the teams and also alongside the races. So photographers are very much an important part of cycling because it's such a big journey, a bike race. It goes from point to point, as everybody knows, and it does require these very sort of agile and adaptable people who follow it on various forms of, you know, motorbikes and cars and just purely from the side of the road. So, yeah, I would think photography is integral to the sport.
And we can almost trace the history of photography in cycling and the history of cycling in photography here, Guy, can't we, in your book?
For sure.
It feels actually like cycling in the popular imagination, the imagination of those three most important countries, perhaps, France, Italy and Spain, for the sport, that actually it was the photography that perhaps drew out the popularity of the sport, especially in those early days where people could actually see their heroes, see how tough it was to do some of those climbs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think what's quite interesting is that a lot of the archive material has never seen the light of day, which I think is almost a tragedy, really. I mean, I'm working with a few other archives at the moment, putting some other books together, but it's quite interesting how a lot of picture editors of the day would only use one or two photographs. And obviously when, you know, you've got the likes of, as I said, Robert Capa shooting, you know, maybe two or three films a day, there's some amazing photography that just got literally left on the cutting room floor. So, and that is often the case, I think, with a lot of sport, where the photographers were very engaged with the sport and they've really understood the sport. And they obviously took a lot of photographs. But then the newspapers would only have space for maybe one or, you know, perhaps in a reportage magazine away down the line, there may be two or three, four more. But generally speaking, a lot of the stuff got left behind. So it's quite interesting how, and especially with Magnum, because, you know, they have great care with their archive. And obviously a lot of it is actually used and shown to the public. So it's kind of an interesting balance between a sports archive and, you know, something like Magnum, which is a little bit more highbrow, I suppose you'd say. But it's interesting how, you know, the photographers that we uncovered whilst we were doing the research for the book, we found that, you know, they had cycling photography and, you know, they were all drawn to the race. They were all drawn to the idea, not just in the Tour de France, but obviously the Tour of Italy and in John Vink's case to the races in Belgium. So, you know, there's this very much this idea that that cycling is something that the photographer is drawn to.
Well, let me ask you, Guy, as an editor with your critical eye, is there a particular era, is there a particular race, or maybe most particularly, is there a particular rider who, you know, you're always looking for? Is it an archive image you've never seen before? Obviously, a lot of people who follow cycling closely or have done over the years will look to someone like Eddy Merckx, and, you know, sometimes a rarity will come to light and it will give another insight into this amazing mind, this amazing body. Do you have your favourites, or, as with so many people, particularly when you've done a book, you can't choose between them?
Well, I think one of my favourites appears in the Magnum book, which is a French writer called Laurent Fignon, who was quite an interesting character. He was quite a difficult guy for the journalists to follow very often. He was quite a petulant kind of character when he was racing. He was a very interesting looking fella. So I think the photography of him by Guy Le Querac in the book, I was really delighted to find, and obviously fascinated to hear Guy's recollections of that photo story. So I think, yeah, I mean, there are some others as well. I mean, Jacques Anquetil is one that I always think is very compelling to look at. I mean, he's a bit like the sort of the French Fausto copy, if you like. I think the thing with Merckx is Merckx was very much a very photographed sporting hero, if you like, whereas some of the people that were photographed in the book are very much the kind of the sidelines. I mean, there's some interesting, obviously I won't go into all the stories that are in the book, but there were some interesting sidelines of stories of, you know, riders that have basically been, you know, never been heard of before. And the Magnum photographers got quite interested in them. So it's, yeah, I think for me personally, the stories that are in the book actually sort of highlight and echo a lot of my history, because a lot of it is the sort of mid-80s, mid-80s cycling, Tour de France. So the likes of Bernardino and Laurent Fignon, Greg LeMond, they all kind of appear from time to time in the photographs. So for me, it's a bit of a dream job, really.
So there's an idea of quite a lot of kind of, there's a bit of instant nostalgia in there.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. For me, it's very much looking back over you know, when I first started getting into cycling. So.
And what got you into cycling? I mean, aside from the fact that it's a deeply exhilarating sport, there is something very photogenic about it, isn't there? It was what we see from this book, but we know from ourselves, from the different coloured jerseys, the sponsorship, the bikes. There is something, and if a good bike race happens also to be happening in a photogenic sun-dappled town, so much the better. What was the genesis of the love affair for you, Guy?
I think it's very much the Tour de France. Actually, strangely, going to visit the Tour de France in the mid '80s for me was the thing that really got it into my blood, if you like. I mean, previous to that, I mean, you know, cycling was something that my family had always done. So, you know, it was a little bit, it was a bit of a natural progression just to start riding a bike. But from the point of view of racing, it was the Tour de France that really captured my imagination. I mean, especially in the mid '80s, I think it was such a huge event, and it was still quite magical in the fact that it wasn't very, it wasn't a particularly Anglophile sort of event. It was very French, and I liked that. I liked the fact that it was kind of other. It wasn't football, it wasn't cricket, it wasn't rugby, it wasn't an English sport per se. It was very much a continental European sport, and I find that quite romantic and quite alluring from my point of view. And I know a lot of my friends did at the time as well. You know, the names of all the riders and obviously the equipment and everything was this sort of kind of slightly magical sort of experience, I think.
Guy, there's a real sense of that romance, of the nostalgia with this book. And I guess it's hard not to look at that through the prism of what, in particular, the Tour de France has become. And I guess some of the challenges that cycling has had to contend with in the last, decade or so, you know, there's always been questions about how these unbelievable athletes were managing to power themselves through. But has it made you ever question the fundamentals of your love affair with the sport? Some of the problems, it's hard to talk about the big figures in the sport and not mention the Lance Armstrongs or the Pantanis, this kind of thing. Does any of that make you question it, or does it just make you all the more nostalgic about how things used to be?
Possibly. I mean, I personally think it's the events that make cycling more than the individuals. I mean, it's interesting, I was talking to Greg LeMond just recently, and he was saying how the stars of cycling are like actors on a stage. You know, they come and go, but the events remain like plays and like opera and what have you. They all remain pretty much the same. So I suppose it's a bit like, you know, you go to the Tour de France and you have that recollection of the romance and the nostalgia of your, if you like, your golden age, because everybody has their own golden age, don't they? They have their... I mean, I know a lot of my friends now, you know, when they came into cycling, Lance Armstrong was the thing that brought them into cycling. So in many respects, that's probably more a pertinent question for them than it is for me. You know, there is actually a photo story in the book about Lance Armstrong. You know, we didn't shy away from the idea. I mean, it was Christopher Anderson who shot him, not literally, but he photographed him back in the day when Lance was at his height. During his relationship with Sheryl Crow. So Christopher Anderson photographed him at her house in the Hollywood Hills. And one of the reasons why we included it in the book was because it was a very personal photo story of somebody who had been put into the press at the time as being this kind of superhero figure and has since been, obviously, been undone. So I think those pictures actually are quite important because they do show a slightly sort of private side of somebody who was at the time was just this massive superstar, and obviously everybody knows the story of his downfall. So it was interesting talking to Christopher Anderson as well, because he'd spent a fair bit of time with Lance, and his whole sort of opinion of Lance at the time and also now. I mean, obviously, you know, if you read the book, you'll find out more, but it's just quite interesting how he sees, you know, how he saw it then and how he sees it now. And I think that's the thing. It's very, very easy to look back with hindsight and say, ah, well, they were all doping. But the events at the time are very, very different, in the same way that the events of the Tour de France right now are very, very different. I mean, people look at them as on face value. I mean, that is what sport is about. You know, you watch it, it's entertainment, and you watch it and you trust in it and you believe in it. And sadly, unfortunately, sometimes that is it's not what it appears to be. But I mean, my point of view on it is I would never condone taking drugs. I personally wouldn't myself. But I do still see cycling as entertainment, pure and simple. And I think a lot of people who are quite pious about it and quite critical of it possibly don't really understand the cultural and the social and the sort of ethical reasons behind why people dope in the first place. I personally don't feel like I'm the right person to judge them.
Well, Guy, it's a beautiful, it's a wide-ranging book. I hope we've covered most of the topics in it in our brief chat there. I mean,
I'd hate to end on doping.
Well, because... there you go. Well, we can. I was going to talk about the very beautiful pictures of the sort of Northern European velodromes, but we don't have time, Guy Andrews. We don't have time. Get thee to thy bicycle and cycle around Mallorca, you poor sod.
Thank you very much.
We should point people in the direction of the book. It's beautiful. It's called Magnum Cycling, and it's out on the 25th of April. Guy Andrews, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And there we have it, Tom. Episode 354 of the Monocle Weekly. Did you enjoy it?
I absolutely enjoyed it, Rob. I'm a bit of a cycling... I'm not an aficionado by any means. I'm not even a sort of cycling nut who can tell you all of the details. But I love the way that that sport in particular is documented. I was always fan of Rouleau magazine.
Yeah.
And it was great to talk to Guy, one of the originators there. And as you said, a creative force behind a beautiful tome.
I cycled everywhere in my teenage years. Absolutely adored it. Loved it. Cycled hundreds of miles in a day. Adored it. Loved the voice of Phil Liggett, obviously.
Yeah.
And who better? What's the best name in the history of cycling? It's got to be the Azerbaijani, or is he Kazakhstani sprint specialist from the early 90s, Jamaluddin Abdujaparov.
Abdujaparov,
what a great name that is.
I remember him well, and I'm highly impressed with your powers of recall and pronunciation. Was it Jamaluddin Abdujaparov who struck one of the Coke bottle things that was on the run-in, famously on the Champs-Élysées, and took a spectacularly awful crash?
A spectacular tumble. Who, another fine sprinter, good hair, Mario Cipollini. What about him? Do you remember him?
Cipollini, of course. Rattling through some of my favourites.
Love these guys.
If only Guy Andrews was... I was going to say still with us. He's still with us in that respect.
He hasn't come off his bike in Mallorca.
He's out pedalling around Mallorca.
He's got a nice job, hasn't he, Guy Andrews?
Pretty good.
Oh, I'll edit that book. Yeah, whatever. I'll edit that book. I'll go for a ride. I'll get a suntan. It's fine. Maybe I'll go for a swim later.
It's agreeable. He's probably got one of those very, very professional cyclist tans as well, with the sleeves and the legs and the white trunk. That's what they tend to have.
A white trunk.
But yeah, classic. A classic
I don't
edition.
Want to think about his trunk.
No, okay.
Let's not do what we did at the beginning of the show.
No, let's end.
And put off all our listeners.
Let's end strongly. Let's end classily.
Okay, let's end classily. Let's also thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio managers were Claire Urban and Chris Grimes. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound,
and I've been Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.